Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and National Grassroots and Outreach Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We'll be discussing a preview of PPI's report on candidate policies and pay-fors, as well as the Congressional Budget Office's latest 10-year federal budget outlook. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that senior House Democrats plan to test the waters for letting spending earmarks make a comeback. The goal in an upcoming meeting of members of the party is to size up the political support, or lack thereof, for restoring the power of lawmakers to insert earmarks in spending bills after a decade without them. A Republican majority imposed a ban in 2011 in response to mounting concerns about corruption, and earmarks have yet to return under Democratic control. Should a large number of House Democrats, particularly those in swing districts, object to the idea, it's unlikely that the Appropriations Committee would proceed with soliciting project requests for the fiscal year 2021 spending bills. And even if Democrats are broadly supportive, having limited earmarks in the House could create headaches for conferencing the bills with the GOP-controlled Senate, where the practice is still banned. Lawmakers will try again this week to build support for a major infrastructure spending initiative. House Democrats plan to roll out an infrastructure framework, and the House Ways and Means Committee also plans to hold a hearing to examine options for financing a building boom in roads, bridges, water systems, airports, and other infrastructure. While both parties have expressed support for such a program and concept, they have never agreed on how much spending is required and how to pay for it. President Trump and House Democrats looked close to reaching a comprehensive infrastructure agreement in early May of last year when the president appeared to embrace the notion of a bill that could cost up to $2 trillion over 10 years. But politics ultimately shut down those discussions. Even as they enjoyed years of economic growth, state governments have been pumping up their reserve funds to guard against a downturn. Cash reserves could become more important this year as experts project the economy to slow down in 2020. Though a full-scale recession seems less likely than it did at points last year, a slower rate of growth still appears likely. Fitch Ratings, a credit ratings agency, projects a 1.7% expansion in 2020, which would be the lowest level since 2011. The median state rainy day fund grew to 7.6% of general fund expenses in fiscal year 2020, a record and a significant increase from 1.6% in fiscal year 2011, according to a study by the National Association of State Budget Officers. Two more states could have ballot initiatives this fall to expand Medicaid. Grassroots groups in Oklahoma and Missouri are working to get a vote on expanding Medicaid programs on the ballot as soon as this fall, following the approval of similar ballot initiatives in conservative states in 2018. If the initiatives are successful, those states would join 36 others in the District of Columbia in expanding Medicaid eligibility to people with income up to 138% of the federal poverty line. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government would pay 90% of the costs for individuals who gain coverage under expansion. The Congressional Budget Office released its new budget forecast this week, and the Penn-Wharton budget model, a product of the University of Pennsylvania, thinks it has an answer on why corporate income tax revenue has been lower than projected in recent years. PWBM said the drop-off in corporate income revenue can be explained by lower-than-expected corporate profits. Corporate income tax receipts were $46 billion lower in 2019 than the CBO had projected in April of 2018. But if the CBO's 2018 projection is adjusted for revised data showing lower corporate profits, the predicted receipts in 2019 would fall from $275 billion to $210 billion, according to the model. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We'll be getting a preview of PPI's take on 2020 candidate policy proposals and pay-fors. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. Bob, you know well. He's a regular contributor on the show. Prior to joining PPI, Ben staffed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings, and he worked on other federal budget issues at BPC, including sequestration, budget process reform, and the federal debt limit. Before that, he was the legislative outreach director for the Concord Coalition. So Ben is one of my former colleagues. Welcome back to the show, Bob and Ben.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks.
Happy to have you both back on Facing the Future. Today, we are discussing a bit of a preview of a report that PPI is putting out later this week that takes a closer look at the 2020 presidential candidates' policies and proposals, as well as their pay-fors. And before we get into any specifics on that end, Ben, why don't you just give us a quick high-level summary of the report itself, maybe some of your key findings, and why you decided to put this together?
Sure. So as most of you probably know, the Iowa caucuses are less than a week away. So voters, after a campaign that's been going on for nearly a year, are finally going to start voting to select the Democratic nominee for president. And over the course of this year, a lot of candidates, most of the candidates, have put out tons and tons of different campaign policy proposals and promises that they're making to try to win over voters. And we thought it was important that as they get ready to go into the voting booth, voters have a good sense of what it is the candidates are promising, what the different visions that they're being asked to choose among, and how realistic these different promises are. So we wanted to put together a comprehensive review that gives them that guidance.
And I should say, before we go too much further, that this is PPI's view and perspective, not necessarily something that Facing the Future or the Concord Coalition endorses, but it's an open dialogue we're having about some of the costs and ways to pay for a lot of what these candidates might be promising or standing on in terms of their platform. With that being said, Ben, when you were looking at the variety of proposals out there for these candidates, did you lump them into certain spending or revenue categories?
Yes. So we mainly looked at two things. The first is how much of what each candidate is proposing goes towards public investments in the future versus present consumption. So when we talk about public investments in the future, we're thinking about things like education, infrastructure, and scientific research that really lay the foundation for long-term economic growth. Whereas present consumption, we're thinking more of programs like Social Security, Medicare, National Defense, programs that are for fulfilling, you know, current needs. They're important government services, but they're not necessarily growing the economy in the long term. So we wanted to see both what it was that candidates are proposing, and then the second thing was how much they're proposing in total and how they would pay for their different promises.
And Bob, could you put those categories in perspective when it comes to the federal budget, you know, public investments, where those might fall in terms of, say, discretionary or mandatory spending, and where consumption or transfer payments might fall?
Well, if you look at the total budget, transfer payments constitute around 70%, and it doesn't mean the rest of it is investment. It just means that it's the payments to individuals is the vast majority of the budget, and then you have interest on the debt, which is a little bit more. So investments, what's categorized as investments in the budget, is very, very small. And Ben, you may have a number for this, but I think it's around 12% or 11% or something like that.
It is even less than that. We did a report last year, or I guess it's now 2 years ago, called Ending America's Public Investment Drought. We looked at the what portion of the budget goes to public investment, and it was less than 8% in 2018, I believe.
That is a number that's been coming down, that's been trending down steadily over the decades. There's been a transformational shift in the budget from programs that are funded annually, which include investments, and the mandatory spending programs, which are mostly the transfer payments.
So, Ben, can you give some historical context there to the trends that Bob was just highlighting in terms of numbers? I know we're headed downward. Where are we coming down from? And do you have any hope when you're looking at the proposals by these presidential candidates, whether that trend could be reversed, whether we'll see more public investment in the future?
Yeah, so in our report, we looked back at where public investment spending was historically, and we found that, you know, back in 1968, public investment was about 13% of the budget, and so that's compared to less than 8% today. Thinking about it in real terms, you compared to the size of the economy, if we were spending the same percentage of economic resources on federal public investment today that we were spending back then, it would have been about $500 billion. And in reality, we only spent $300 billion on public investment last year. And so that's a big cut, a fall of about 40%. And it's only going to get worse as time goes on. Now, that said, the presidential campaigns have all made a number of commitments for restoring the strength of public investment in the budget. I believe that every candidate has proposed at least $2 trillion of new public investment spending over the next decade, so $200 billion a year. That's basically plugging that gap. Some of them would go above and beyond and spend even more than that, which some of that's a good thing. Others have proposed even more enormous levels. You know, Bernie Sanders in particular has proposed, you know, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion of new public investment spending. That is certainly a big focus of a lot of the candidates, is reversing that decline.
So, Ben, this push by candidates to restore public investment spending, is that done at the consequence or cost of other things? Do they pull money from other areas of the budget, or is this largely entirely new spending on top of where we already are and perhaps where we're already headed?
So every candidate has proposed just new spending. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have talked a lot about cutting defense spending as part of their pay-fors, but pretty much every candidate has proposed a net increase in both investment and non-investment spending. Some of them have also said how they would pay for it. So Pete Buttigieg, by our analysis, is the only candidate who has said how he would pay for the entirety of his new spending proposals. So it's not coming at the expense of anything else, any other government services. Contrast that to someone like Bernie Sanders. We found that Bernie Sanders has offered plans to pay for less than half of his agenda and half of his new spending increases. And so what that means is that even though he says that these different priorities are all going to happen, in reality they would almost certainly get pitted against each other if he actually tried to enact it.
So you're talking about whether candidates pay for their policies, proposals or not, and, you know, what percentage of them or what percentage of it is covered by new revenue. A lot of these candidates claim that what they've put out there is, in fact, paid for. So what you're telling me or what you're telling our listeners is that that's not necessarily true. Why is that? Is there a fair amount of double dipping on, say, new taxes, or are there relatively rosy projections in terms of revenue or economic growth? Why is it that a candidate can claim on stage, yeah, these things are paid for, but then when you dig into the details, it's not necessarily the case?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that this is an ongoing campaign and that new proposals are going to come out from the candidates as time progresses. And so we only looked at the details that campaigns have already made public, but they may have plans forthcoming to pay for things that haven't been announced yet. And so that's one thing we think is important to keep in mind. That said, sometimes there has been a big difference between what a campaign says something costs and what independent estimates say they cost. And so I think that's a particularly big case with Senators Sanders and Warren. I think there's a big disagreement in some areas between what they say they'll pay, what they say they can pay for, given the cost, and what independent estimates find their plans would actually cost. But then there's also an element of the fact that they just haven't necessarily said how they'll pay for it yet.
And Bob, this might be a good time to bring you in, because I know you've done some digging as well to see what's publicly facing in terms of pay-fors and policy proposals by these candidates. And I think you just had something published locally here in New Hampshire that talks about your findings. So for the benefit of our listeners, can you tell us what you looked at, what you found, and what you would be hoping to see right now from these candidates only weeks away from, well, a week away, I think, from the caucus and the primary in New Hampshire?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of a complimentary review from what Ben was describing. I kind of ran an experiment of looking at the candidate websites and looking for any references to the debt, the deficit, fiscal responsibility, to see if they made it a priority and if they discussed it at all, how they did so. And so I wasn't adding up proposals, but obviously in going through the website, I was cognizant of the cost estimates that they gave and any offsets they gave, because a secondary part of my analysis was, okay, maybe they don't have a specific reference to the importance of the debt, but that's okay if what they're doing is, if they're showing us the math, what they're proposing and what the offsets are, that implicitly shows that at least they don't think deficits are irrelevant. If they thought that deficits don't matter, they wouldn't be talking about offsets. So it's maybe an implicit way of dealing with the issue. So that's what I was looking at. I was not looking at anything that did not appear on their website. So a lot of the information that Ben is looking at with PPI. I assume, Ben, that there were some things, maybe some tally sheets from the campaigns that that you had that are not on their website. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think there has been a lot of discussion that did not necessarily come from the candidate's website. But if we found them in a news article saying they were going to support something, and we found them saying the same thing three or four times, we incorporated that even if it wasn't on their website.
Okay, so that's what I was saying. Okay, I'm the average voter. I may not hit these random articles, so I might not see them. So, you know, if I were in Iowa, New Hampshire, one of the Super Tuesday states, and all I have available to me, and obviously we can all, you know, Google things and stuff like that, but because what you put on your website is what you want people to know about you. So, and it's what you're showing your priorities. So that's why, that's all I looked at. And really, I was quite surprised, and maybe I shouldn't have been, but there really wasn't any candidate that had a specific issue tab or dedicated plan on their page, and they have dozens and dozens, and I applaud them for having so many plans and cost estimates. It's good to do that, but there wasn't any that was specifically addressed to the deficit. Now, Bill Weld was the only one that had a specific issue tab that was related to fiscal policy. It's called tax and spending, and then I found a tally sheet on Michael Bennett's website, which in the same place, and that's important, in the same place, listed his spending total, which is, I think, somewhere around $6 trillion, and the specific offsets to follow, which added up to $6 trillion. So that was a positive, which I didn't find on anybody else's website, just kind of a total tally sheet, all in the same place. And then Amy Klobuchar, we found an interesting pledge on that she would, as president, lower the debt-to-GDP ratio over the first term. And I thought, well, that's an interesting pledge. But you really had to go through several clicks to get there. It was a non-intuitive process. And frankly, I stumbled across it by accident. But so now everybody has cost estimates of their proposal. No, I shouldn't say everybody, but I mean, a lot of them have cost estimates of their proposals, but aren't as upfront about the offset on their websites.
And Ben, I want to pivot back to you here. You mentioned the timing of all this, that it may be possible that candidates will put additional proposals out there or additional pay-fors as the campaign progresses. But as noted a few minutes ago, we're very near the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, which is sort of a make-or-break threshold for a lot of these candidates. So in your mind, how realistic is it that you might see new pay-fors thrown out there in the last couple weeks? And then I guess that'll be one part of a two-part question. The second part will be, which candidate or candidates have you found that pay for most of their proposals, or maybe even go beyond that and start addressing the underlying structural budget issues?
So I'll answer the second part of your question first. Who's paid for their proposals and who comes close? So we found that Mayor Buttigieg is the only candidate who has so far laid out a plan to pay for the entirety of his proposals. And we, in fact, found that he has something in the neighborhood of $1 trillion more in pay-fors than he does in new spending proposals. And so that's $1 trillion he could be using to address the underlying structural fiscal problems. Biden also comes close. I think it's important to note that he, even though he hasn't proposed ways to pay for the entirety of his new spending package, he has at least proposed ways to pay for more than the entirety of his non-investment spending increases. And I think his deficit is something that theoretically, I think it would not be hard for him to make proposals for how to close it in the remaining part of the campaign. I think it's probably unlikely that other candidates will be able to close those gaps. I think particularly for Senator Sanders, he has a gap that's well over $20 trillion. You know, that's the annual gross domestic product of the United States, all the goods and services we produce in a given year. His 10-year deficit is more than that, so I think it's unlikely that he would be able to make such proposals during the second part of the campaign. But I would say that, number one, hopefully that when this analysis comes out, maybe we'll get lucky and candidates will use it as an impetus to fill in their remaining gaps, and also if they start hearing voters' demand or through their votes express a desire to see more pay-fors, then maybe that'll happen.
And since Bob mentioned some candidates by name earlier in the segment, I should ask you, which candidates' proposals and policies did you analyze for this particular report that's coming out later this week?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Chase. We focused on the four leading candidates, the ones who have been leading in the polls up until this point. So former Vice President Joe Biden, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Senator Bernie Sanders. We did try to, towards the end, see if we could do an analysis of Senator Amy Klobuchar and Mayor Michael Bloomberg, given how they've been rising in the polls lately. But we couldn't find enough information out there, both from the campaigns and from other independent analysts who took a look at this. We didn't feel we could put together a credible, comprehensive review for them the way we did for these other four candidates.
How realistic or bipartisan do you think a lot of these proposed pay-fors are for these new policies or public investments? Do you think it's a realistic package that if that particular candidate were stepping in as president, they plop these policies on the table and say, let's do it? How realistic is it that they could get it done?
Well, let me make an overall comment on what's realistic. If you look at, strictly speaking, what's realistic in addressing our nation's fiscal policies, you could come to the conclusion that nothing is. Because if you're going to address fiscal problems, they all require very difficult choices that are politically, quote-unquote, unrealistic. When you're looking at new proposals that candidates are putting out there and ways of financing them, again, you could say they're not realistic because they're aspirations. And I think the pay-fors are probably even more aspirational and more subject to scrutiny because they're the bad side of new good stuff. And so I would take realism with a grain of salt in all of that. You know, that doesn't mean you don't scrutinize them for credibility. I think you can, but I would say are the estimates credible per se, not whether they're politically realistic. Because given the gridlock in Washington right now, nothing is politically realistic. So I don't think candidates should be penalized for having aspirations or big plans. If the distinction, in my view, is if somebody says that something is going to cost, $5 trillion, and most independent analysts look at it and say, no, it's going to cost $10 trillion, that's a problem. I'm going to raise, $10 trillion in revenue from taxing widgets, and most people say, no, you can't possibly get that amount of money from taxing widgets. So that's the kind of reality check that I'm interested in, not in tamping down people's aspirations.
So, Ben, piggybacking off of what Bob just said, credibility seems to me a pretty big issue in terms of understanding, or at least something very important when analyzing these candidate proposals and policies. So how did you approach the issue of credibility? And in that framework, who did you determine might be credible?
So what I think a good measure of credibility is when we take when we compile the totality of the estimates from campaigns and independent estimates, does it look like the spending and revenues roughly add up in a way that makes sense? And so for Buttigieg, he has laid out enough revenue to pay for the entirety of his plans. That, to me, says that, and that's by independent estimates combined with our own, combined with the campaigns. So I say that seems credible to me. Vice President Biden still has something of a gap, but it's less than the $2 trillion tax cut that Republicans passed in 2017, and so that's a gap that could very conceivably be filled, and so that to me also seems credible. I think with Senator Sanders, as I said earlier in the podcast, with a $20 trillion gap, and $20 trillion is understating it, it's a little more than that, that to me does not seem credible. It doesn't seem realistic, doesn't seem honest. And then I think Senator Warren falls somewhere in between on that spectrum. She's got a pretty sizable gap, much bigger than Biden's, about four or five times as big. But it's still sort of in the realm where, maybe she could potentially fill it, although it would certainly be hard to do so while adhering to this pledge of hers that she would not raise taxes on the middle class. I think that's probably not credible.
So as we close out this segment, I have a question for each of you, and it's probably a very similar question. For you, Ben, it's what do you hope will come from this report when it's published later this week? And Bob, what charge would you give all the candidates in these closing weeks of the primary?
So what I would like to see from this report is two things. Number one, a greater focus on public investment spending. We talk a lot. There's been a lot of discussion in the campaign, and Senator Klobuchar pointed this out in some of the previous debates, that more is better. As Buttigieg said, we shouldn't be measuring the value of an idea by how much it's adding to the Treasury's costs. I think that we should be looking at not who can spend the most, but who can spend the smartest. And so I think it's important that there's more focus on these investments that lay the foundation for long-term economic growth. I would say the second thing I hope that comes from this report is that there is more of a discussion about what candidates have promised and whether it's realistic or not. I think that I would like to see more candidates fill in the gaps that are left, and for candidates who haven't articulated adequately how they can pay for things, I think there should be more scrutiny and questioning of should they really get credit for proposing this if it's not remotely realistic.
Yeah, I would like to see in the closing days of this campaign, and also for those that survive the New Hampshire-Iowa gauntlet, I would encourage each of them to put up a separate issue tab on their budget, on their website, that says, here's my budget. I mean, here's what I'm proposing, and here is what I can offer to pay for these things. And if it doesn't add up, just say why. I mean, why you think either you think that deficits don't really matter, or that what you're doing is going to have a good effect on the economy, and so the numbers are better than they may appear. I think that that sort of transparency with the voters is important, rather than having things scattered throughout the website, because you can put stuff up and say, you know, here's a siloed proposal, and I'm showing you how to pay for it. But the important thing is, what's the totality of the proposals, and what are the offsets? So that's what I would like to see. Plus, I'd really like to put it in some context of the nation's existing fiscal picture, so that even if you pay for every new proposal you want, we're still on an unsustainable path right now. So you really need to go beyond. If you think that the debt is a problem, that the rising deficits and debt is a problem, you really need to come up with a plan that does more than just pay for new things. You have to take steps to correct that unsustainable path. So I just urge more transparency on the websites for the candidates. And it's not enough to just raise it at town hall meetings and rallies. It really means something if you put it on your website.
This is Facing the Future. I have been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz from the Progressive Policy Institute. We've been discussing a preview of PPI's assessment of candidate proposals and whether they pay for their investments in the future, which can be found at progressivepolicy.org as of January 30th. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show once again by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob.
You're welcome, Chase.
So I know we just had you in the last segment, but we have a very important report that just came out hot off the presses from the Congressional Budget Office. It's their latest 10-year budget outlook. And I think it's rather timely to discuss what the CBO had to say about the next 10 years of federal budgets. So take it away.
Well, all right. If you like budgets, deficits in excess of $1 trillion for the foreseeable future, that's what we've got.
I can't say that I do, Bob. I don't want to start off on that.
Confronting those presidential and even congressional candidates, this is what they face if they are lucky enough to win. The CBO is projecting a deficit of $1 trillion this year, almost even, and $1 trillion next year, and then gradually rising to about $1 trillion, each year, steadily rising till 10 years out, they've got the deficit around $1.7 trillion, moving substantially over 5% of GDP for an annual deficit. That's pretty bad. And on a sustained basis, it's even worse.
Where does 5% of GDP fall in terms of what's historically normal for us?
The 50-year average is 2.9, so pretty large. It's a pretty substantial increase, and of course, it's on a continuing basis and getting bigger. And this year's deficit is projected to be 4.6% of GDP, and then it keeps gradually inching up. Debt held by the public, which is the key measure of debt as a percentage of GDP, comes in just under 100% of GDP over the 10-year outlook, 98.3% of GDP, up from about 81% this year. So again, steadily moving up in all of them moving kind of in the wrong direction.
And just to, for the benefit of our listeners here, sort of laying a foundation, what does CBO use in terms of its base analysis? Do they rely on existing law, or are they factoring in policy trends and maybe what's more likely to happen politically?
They just stick to current law. They don't make guesses about what Congress might do. So it is a literal interpretation of current law. And one of the things to watch for here is that current law assumes that the individual tax cuts that were passed in 2017 are going to expire at the end of 2025. And so the if you look at this baseline, it assumes that there's going to be a revenue spike after that. And so the revenue figures are probably inflated for the latter part of this 10-year outlook, which means that things could actually be worse in terms of the deficit if that is if those tax cuts were to be extended.
And I know we've talked in the past on the show about how economic growth over the next 10 to 20 years or so is expected to level out at just under 2%. What a lot of the economists or experts say. Does CBO take a similar view? Do they project any kind of recession, or does it not even go there? Are these numbers absent any kind of economic or serious economic downturn?
Yeah, CBO can't tell you when a recession's going to hit. Nobody can, really. So they do not factor in a recession. What they do is just kind of smooth things out. And, I mean, they don't project high periods or low periods. They lock in on a trend rate, and they take things from where it is now, and they say, you know, here's the long-term trend. The long-term trend here is down in terms of economic growth. Doesn't mean a recession, but it means that factors that propel the economy in a structural way, like labor force growth and productivity, are trending downward and are projected to continue to trend downward. And that means that economic growth is projected to go under 2% and settle in at around 1.7% adjusted for inflation over the 10-year period. And that's substantially slower than we've been used to in prior decades.
And I know this report just came out, so it's sort of a knee-jerk response here, and you haven't had a lot of time to really dive into the numbers. But when you first took a look at it, were there any major changes from years past in terms of some of the figures that you saw CBO throwing out there?
Yes, there was a bit of a holy cow moment when I first opened it and looked at it, because CBO updated their long-term outlook, which goes over 30 years. And it is substantially worse than the one that they did in June of last year. And, you know, so I went immediately to find out what made the long-term outlook. And, you know, frankly, 30 years isn't that long-term. I mean, you think about it. It may seem like a long time, but particularly the younger you are, you know, you want to know what the trend lines are for the budget and the economy. And, you know, this was a little bit of a shocker that the numbers were so much worse. So as far as what the factors are, you know, why that is, revenue is projected to be lower. Spending is projected to be higher, and economic growth is projected to be lower. And let me get into those a little bit. The revenue projection is interesting because of two factors. One, in December, Congress canceled a major tax that had never been implemented but was included in the projections. It was the so-called Cadillac tax on high-cost health care plans. It was part of the Affordable Care Act. It was going to help pay for the Affordable Care Act. And Congress, just kind of casually canceled it as on their way out the door in December. And it had a major impact on assumed revenue over the next 10 years, over the long term. The other thing is that the CBO, in assuming a slower growing economy, that means also slower growing revenue. So there's a big dip of almost a full percentage point of GDP lower in revenues. And 1% may not sound like a big deal, but when you're talking about 1% of GDP, that's a big deal. So lower revenues, higher spending projected, mostly because Congress, also on its way out the door in December, took caps off the discretionary spending. And really significantly is that they did lower their long-term growth rate down to 1.6%, and that's, you know, adjusted for inflation. So it's lower than they had projected before. And you put all those factors together, and if you look beyond the 10-year budget window, it's flashing red lights.
So organizationally, how did the Concord Coalition respond to CBO's latest numbers?
With horror.
I have to say, I share the sentiment.
You know, really, we did put out a statement as soon as the numbers came out, and we're working. We'd be putting out a longer statement on it, but it really is important to get people focused on this. You just, you know, hear people that are in fantasy land talking about what you can do with this sort of a budget situation, and it's always important to underscore that this assumes that you're running this big, huge budget deficit in the face of a growing economy, maybe a slow growing economy, but a growing economy, and no obvious thing like a major disaster or military action that would cause a spike in spending. These are just trends that are producing these huge budget deficits, and unfortunately, those trends are pretty much locked in place.
So we're coming near the end of this segment, and I have two questions. You almost fed right into where I wanted to go here, Bob. How should CBO's report factor into candidate proposals, especially in these final weeks of the Iowa caucus, New Hampshire primary, going into Super Tuesday? How should this impact the perspective of a 2020 presidential candidate? And then following up on that, how should the public interpret this information?
I would hesitate to give political advice to any of the candidates, so I won't. What I would like to see happen is candidates making reference to this to inform the public that there is this enormous budget deficit and that they plan to do something about it. Now, they can fit that within their agenda. They don't have to say that, you know, we're gonna slash spending and raise taxes, and we're going to try to, you know, balance the budget anytime soon. But they should acknowledge that this is going to be a problem, and that things are, you know, there's going to have to be some negotiations about that. As far as the public needs to recognize that when they hear candidates, because the candidates are probably not going to do what I just said. So if they don't hear that, they ought to know on their own that this is a very challenging time for the budget, and it's going to get worse if whoever is elected in November doesn't come in with a plan to do something about these underlying structural budget deficits, because the rest of their agenda is you're not going to be able to finance anything or cut taxes, if that's what you want to do, with this enormous budget deficit going on. People just won't allow it.
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We've been discussing the Congressional Budget Office's latest 10-year budget outlook, which is hot off the presses, just came out this week. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob, and giving your expert analysis on where the country's heading with fiscal policy.
Okay, Chase. Well, I'm not going to jump out the window just yet, but...
oh, boy. So there's reason for concern. Hopefully these candidates wake up, and the public as well. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.